to another episode of Expanded Perspectives. I'm here alone today. That's right. I'm your host, Kyle Filson. I'm here in Skeleton Studios by myself. Cam is out at Area 52 with his wife for a few days. So I'm in here alone, but that's okay. We can get it done. We all just went to the Texas State Fair a couple days ago. My wife and I, Cam and his wife, we went last year too. We usually always go, but Cam and Cynthia, they normally don't go. They went last year, was the first time they've been in years. And so they wanted to go back, and we had a good old time. You know, there's all kinds of things to see, all types of crazy fried foods. I think it's one of the biggest fairs in the United States, if I'm not wrong. And there's a lot of vendors there selling all kinds of things. So we got to see all the new vehicles that are coming out from all the manufacturing companies. I saw a Corvette that I really want. We had a good time. The weather was perfect. It was right before the Texas OU game. That was going to be on the Saturday. And yeah, man, we just had a great time. Look forward to the state fair every year. If you're in Texas around this time of year and you want to take your family there, it's a good thing. It's a good place to visit. Now, I will warn you, it is not cheap. What I mean is everything there, it's a scam, right? They go off the coupon system. So you can't buy things with cash. You have to buy coupons. And so if you want a corn dog, it's like 10 coupons, right? And so you always end up getting, you know, scammed out of some money, because at the end of the day, you always end up with some more coupons. I usually just hand them to some kids that are walking in. I'll never forget, a couple of years ago, we took the boys when they were little. I want to say like 10 years ago. And I had like $400. And I'm like, man, we are going to have a heck of a day at the state fair. It's going to take us, we're just going to have a great time. We went to the Midway, where all the rides are and the games you can play. And they blew through that $400 in like 40 minutes. I was like, I'm bus, kids. We got to go home. I thought this was going to be an all day long thing. And you guys broke me. So like I said, the state fair is awesome, but it's not cheap. So just be warned of that. Let's get into some stories. This first story comes to us from Southern California, where a man heard strange footsteps crunching across his garage roof. What he discovered under the beam of his flashlight was a towering red-eyed figure unlike anything human that left him shaken and still searching for answers. It says, "Hi, I live in Southern California, just north of San Diego. Here's my story, and I'll try to keep it brief. In a previous house I rented, I had a separate garage where I operated a ham shack and set up a workbench for assembling printed circuit boards. I spent most of my evenings in that shed, and nothing unusual ever happened, except for listening to the radio. One night, while I was out working on a circuit board, I started hearing what sounded like strange crunching sounds on the roof of the garage, like someone with a heavy weight was walking on it. Given that I had set up several antennas on the roof for different frequencies, I wondered if one of my antennas was making noise or if someone was up there doing something to the antennas. I immediately grabbed my Maglite, one of those big metal flashlights, and walked outside to the back of the garage to shine the light up onto the roof. What I saw was incredible, and it still freaks me out to this day. I can't fully understand what I witnessed. It appeared to be a tall, black figure, at least 6 feet to 6.5 foot tall. It looked like a person, but man, it wasn't quite human. It had reddish eyes, and it just stood there, staring back at me. I thought to myself that this must be someone in some sort of disguise. Then I made up my mind to catch this figure, because I wasn't going to allow it to stay on my roof. It stood frozen for a moment, just staring at me. Then it turned to the left and walked towards the edge of the roof, hopping off easily. The jump looked so effortless, and I could hear it hit the ground. I rushed to the front of the garage, but by the time I got there, it was gone. Nowhere to be found. There were no footprints. Nothing. Nothing at all was left behind. I still can't explain what it was. It was something I've never experienced before in my life, and it left me stunned. Aaron." Wow. I can't even imagine seeing something like that. But again, sounds a lot like a gargoyle. Or the Jeepers Creepers, right? Some sort of demon. I don't know, man. I would be leaving that rental quite soon after that. I don't want anything, any part of it. Now that, and also, this took place in Southern California. For whatever reason, it seems like a lot of these flying gargoyles or humanoids or jeepers creepers-like creatures appear in the Midwest more often than other places. Now, I know that we covered a spree of gargoyle sightings in Florida, but most of them appear in the Midwest and mostly around Chicago for whatever reason. I got another one. Speaking of Chicago or the Midwest, this took place in August 1975 near Davenport, Iowa. These three children saw what looked like a towering winged gargoyle-like entity that shimmered into view, kind of like the Glimmer Man. Check this out. It says, in August 1975, near Davenport, Iowa, just a few weeks before school started, my brother, my best friend, and I were playing in the yard of our dumpy mobile home park, where the trailers were all packed tightly together. Suddenly, we heard a dog howling from across the street. Curious, we ran over to see what was happening. As we got closer, we saw a large Doberman thrashing on its back, howling in distress. It was a mean guard dog, owned by someone who was just as unpleasant. Then, I noticed a shimmer in the air. Whatever it was, it appeared to be about 4 foot tall, reminiscent of something like out of the movie The Predator. After a few seconds, this figure started moving towards the trailer, climbing up the side and across the roof. When it finally did manifest itself, it appeared to be 7 to 8 foot tall, resembling a gargoyle with a strange monkey-like face. It turned its head to look at us with glowing orange eyes that illuminated the area. We were mainly transfixed, but I managed to shout, "Don't look at it! Don't look at it!" Still, we couldn't help ourselves. After about 10 or 15 seconds, the creature spread its wings and shot straight up into the air with a whoosh and an eerie cry that I'll never forget. That sound snapped us out of our trance, and we bolted back to our homes. When we tried to tell our mom what we had seen, she dismissed it as just a made-up story and told us to go back outside. Well, my brother and I weren't having it, so we hid in our bedrooms for the rest of the day. By nightfall, though, we had both started feeling unwell. We experienced symptoms consistent with actinic conjunctivitis, an eye condition some people report after claiming to have seen a UFO. It's also known as Klieg conjunctivitis. I'd felt bad for about 2 to 3 days, while my brother, on the other hand, was sick for a week. Before school started, I visited my friend, but his mother said he was still sick as well and had been for about 2 to 3 weeks. When school finally resumed, we faced a choice: take a pleasant 10-minute walk through some tiny woods to our school, or ride a dirty, crowded school bus for half an hour. We chose the school bus. During the first week back, the auditorium was filled with students sharing their summer stories. To my surprise, someone else talked about the gargoyle in our area, and they weren't the only ones. This sparked a mini uproar, forcing the school to intervene. They downplayed it as mass hysteria, so they drenched us in schoolwork and provided counseling to those who wouldn't stop talking about it. I recall they even held parent conferences addressing the issue, insisting your children watch too much science fiction and scary movies. There was one girl who wouldn't let it go, and they took her away. I learned to keep quiet about it, knowing it wouldn't change anyone's mind. My mom also pulled me aside, firmly believing it was all my imagination and reassuring me that if it really happened, it was over by now. After about a month of riding the bus and seeing my memory fade, I finally decided to walk home from school. As I passed the trailer where the vicious Doberman lived, a sudden realization hit me. Oh no, that dog is going to get me. I panicked and ran for about 50 feet until I felt safe. Looking back, I saw the Doberman in his doghouse, utterly oblivious to my presence. It struck me as strange, so I made some noise to get its attention, but it didn't stir. Then I recalled the whole episode. Whatever it was, it had attempted to get that dog. I figured the heavy steel dog chain and three terrified kids had prevented it from doing so. I remembered the dog transforming from a fierce guard dog into a lifeless paperweight. I speculated that I was less sick because I had looked at the creature for a shorter amount of time. Eventually, after about 6 months, the Doberman returned to its old self, chasing after us kids once again. When I asked my brother about that time, he said that all he could remember was a giant bird flying around the area, and he couldn't recall the specific events we had experienced. Ryan. Well, Ryan, I think you saw a gargoyle or something like that, whatever people are seeing. But it's crazy that it had an effect on you just by locking eyes with it, making eye contact somehow made you ill. What a wild story. Speaking of wild stories, let's take a break. And when we get back from the break, I'm going to be talking about when nature attacks. Stick with us, folks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. You know, owning gold used to be this complicated thing. Paperwork, high minimums, shady dealers, all that. But Acre Gold has made it super simple. Here's how it works. You pick a plan that fits your budget. Set up small automatic payments every month. And when you've built up enough, Acre Gold sends you real, certified 24-karat gold bars. Swiss made, straight to your door. Discreet, secure, and legit. That's it. No guessing, no big upfront cost, just a steady way to build real wealth over time. I've actually tried it myself, and it works. Some people have been doing this for over 5 years, because honestly, gold never goes out of style. And you've seen the price lately of gold? It's up more than 40% in the last year. So yeah, now is a good time to get in. Stop working for money, let your money start working for you. Check them out at getacregold.com and start stacking today. That's it. Real gold, real ownership, no guesswork, just a smart way to build lasting wealth. Head to getacregold.com and start stacking up your gold today. That's getacregold.com, getacregold.com.
It's a rare occurrence for a wild animal to become a killer of man. Oftentimes, a person accidentally finds themselves in the wrong place at the wrong time. Like a hiker walking through the woods when they come upon some bear cubs and are then attacked by the mother. You can't really blame the bear. She's only looking out for her own, just like any human would. Sometimes, maybe the animal feels threatened. You hear these stories of people who raise a tiger from a cub, only to have it kill them years later. You can't blame the tiger. It's just being a tiger. Some people have this belief that they have some sort of kinship with their animal, including deadly snakes. On Monday's show, I brought forward some interesting cases where animals, for whatever reason, seem to target humans deliberately. They somehow seem to enjoy dispatching helpless humans for nothing more than entertainment. Well, I've got a few more for you. Some of them you probably never heard of before. Let's begin. This first story takes place in Japan between December 9th and December 14th in 1915. Now, when you think of Japan, you immediately think of Tokyo with its bright lights, or perhaps Godzilla or Pokemon. But Japan was much different in 1915. Think more like rural Arkansas. It was during this time that a small village was having some trouble with a local bear. This was a Usuri brown bear, which is a cousin of the Kodiak bear. Larger than the grizzly, they can grow up to 1,500 pounds, or 680 kilograms, and reach a height of 10 feet, or 3 meters. A very large bear indeed. It all started on the 9th of December. A bear attacked the Oda farm. Abi Mayu, the farmer's wife, was caring for a friend's child at the time. The bear broke into the farmhouse and attacked the baby. As Mayu tried to fight off the bear with logs of firewood, the bear turned its attention on the woman, grabbing her in its jaws and dragging her away into the forest. When neighbors arrived, they found the farmhouse in shambles, with puddles of blood on the floor. A search party was soon mobilized to find and kill the bear and recover any of Mayu's remains. They soon found the massive animal, and though they shot it, the bear managed to escape. Mayu's remains were found stashed away in the snow nearby. All that remained was her head and her legs. Nearby, news of the attack reached the Miyoki family. There, the women and children of the Miyoki and Saito families had gathered, and while the men hunted for the bear returned to the Ada home in search of more prey. It was chased off by several of the hunting party. The bear turned its sights on the now unprotected Miyoki farm. Yayo Miyoki was cooking dinner with her baby on her back when the large black bear broke through the farmhouse window. In the panic, the cooking pot was overturned onto the fire, plunging the house in darkness. Yayo was tripped by one of her children clinging to her legs, and as she lay there, the bear attacked the baby on her back. The bear then attacked three more of the children as they tried to hide, before turning on pregnant Taki Sayato. She begged the bear to spare her unborn child before it mauled her. Though her fetus was recovered alive from her body, it perished a short time later. Yayo, meanwhile, had escaped into the night and ran to find help. The men made it back to the village and hurried to the home, where the bear was still on a rampage inside. Though they tried to corner and shoot it, once again, the bear managed to escape. At this point, they believed the bear was unstoppable. Their bullets seemed to have no effect on it whatsoever. It had already killed two women and several children. It must be stopped, but how? One of the villagers said he knew of a man in the hills who was a great hunter and that maybe he could be some help. So the men from the village sought out the expert bear hunter. His name was Yamamoto Hakichi, and he told them that he knew the bear that they were speaking about. He told them the bear's name was Kesagaki, and that it had killed three other women in its life. Yamamoto refused to help them, however. He told them that he had sold his gun long ago for alcohol. News of the bear attacks reached the government, who sent reinforcements to hunt down this rogue animal. Though the bear raided several more farms, stealing winter stockpiles, it could not be tracked or hunted. On the night of December 13th, a sniper on guard at the village saw a shadow moving cautiously at the edge of the forest. He thought it was a person, and he called out to it, but received no response. Realizing it was Kesagaki, he fired, and the bear bolted into the woods. Having once again successfully shot the bear without killing it, the party followed the animal's bloody tracks into the woods the following morning. This time, they were accompanied by no longer retired Yamamoto, who found the bear and finally shot it to death with a borrowed gun, once in the heart and once in the head. The bear was nearly 9 feet tall and 1,250 pounds, and the remains of its victims were found in its stomach. It will never be clear why Kasagaki decided to hunt humans, or why he did so with such brutality, rarely eating his victims, only mauling them. Some believe the bear may have had a brain injury or defect. Some wonder if it was rabid. Others speculate that human encroachment woke the bear from hibernation and sent it on its rampage. So was this the case of just a sick or starving bear trying to survive? Or was it a real-life animal serial killer, hunting the most dangerous game? Whatever the reason, Kasagaki killed 7 people that winter, mostly children. At the site of the attacks now sits a shrine, as well as a reconstruction of the Ada House, and a statue overlooking it all. It is now known as the Sankeibetsu Brown Bear Incident. During the Vietnam War in the 1960s, tiger attacks on humans increased, due in part, at least, to the frequency which bodies lay unburied. Despite claims to the contrary, tigers will scavenge and feed on old kills, be their own or someone else's. Having developed a taste for human flesh, they would then attack soldiers quite readily and did so quite often. What follows is but one example. A man-eating tiger was killed by members of a small recon patrol when the 400-pound cat attacked a 3rd Reconnaissance Battalion Marine in the northwest corner of what was then South Vietnam. The 6-man recon team was on an observation mission near Fire Support Base Alpine, about 6 miles east of the border with Laos when this incident occurred. The team had completed its assignment and was waiting to be lifted by helicopter from the area. Bad weather conditions had prevented their immediate extraction, and the team had posted a 2-man radio watch while the others settled down to sleep. The tiger struck swiftly and silently. "Suddenly I heard somebody scream," said Private First Class Thomas Shainline. "Then somebody else was yelling, 'It's a tiger! It's a tiger!'" Private First Class Roy Reagan, who had been sleeping next to the victim, recalled, "I jumped up and I saw the tiger with its mouth around my partner. All I could think about was to get the tiger away from him. I jumped at the tiger and the cat jerked his head and jumped into a bomb crater about 10 meters away, still holding his prey." The Marines quickly followed the tiger to the crater and opened fire on the beast. They could not be sure which of them actually killed the tiger, since they all fired at it. Once hit, the tiger released his prey, and the man staggered out of the bomb crater. "He looked dazed and asked, 'What happened?'" recalled Private First Class Maurice Howell. The injured Marine was given first aid treatment, and a Marine CH-46 helicopter arrived to pick up the victim, the rest of the team, and the dead tiger. The injured man was rushed to the 3rd Medical Battalion Hospital at Quang Tri, suffering from lacerations and bite wounds on the neck. His identification was withheld for family reasons. Meanwhile, the tiger, measuring 9 feet from head to tail, was transported to the 3rd Reconnaissance Battalion headquarters. The incident took place about 10 miles south of the demilitarized zone, near a spot where a young Marine was slain by a man-eating tiger on the 12th of November, 1967. Military authorities had sent out a Marine contingent and 2 professional South Vietnamese tiger hunters 3 weeks before the attack on a recon team to find the killer tiger and 3 others believed to be in the area. But the hunt failed. During the early 20th century, several villages in the Aberdare area of British East Africa, were terrorized by a rampaging bull African bush elephant. For months, the elephant smashed through villages with impunity, devastating crops, damaging property, and killing humans at will. It seemed to actively seek out and attack human beings, and was so cunning and evasive that it never attacked the same village twice. How many it killed? Is unknown. You see, they didn't keep accurate census numbers in that time period, or in that part of the world, so the true number is really unknown. Several villagers claimed that the bull elephant was responsible for over 150 deaths. Some say more. In one story, after attacking two villagers and killing one by ripping his arms from his torso and pulverizing the body, the elephant of the Aberdare Forest made several more unsuccessful attempts to kill humans. Besides all of the killings, many more people were severely injured and maimed by the murderous marauding elephant. It is believed that the elephant likely killed more unconfirmed victims than those that were able to be confirmed. Once again, a professional hunter, or PH, was hired to take care of this problem, and the reign of terror was finally brought to an end by a man named J.A. Hunter. Hunter learned of the vicious elephant when panicked villagers interrupted one of his hunts for antelope and tell him of an elephant that was wreaking havoc in the area and had brutally killed one of their own. Hunter agreed to hunt the culprit down and tracked it to the Aberdare Forest, where he made an unsuccessful attempt to shoot it and lost its trail. The following day, Hunter followed the beast's path of destruction along a trail of broken and crushed underbrush in the forest after hearing of yet more attacks in the vicinity. When he finally came across the elephant, the infuriated bull immediately charged upon catching Hunter's scent. The hunter dropped the large bull with a high-caliber shot to the head and finished it off with another shot to the neck. A subsequent autopsy of the elephant's carcass turned up a bullet from a previous encounter lodged in a nerve center under its tusk, and it is speculated that the pain from this injury may have caused the bull to have become more aggressive than usual. It is also surmised that the perpetrator of the bullet wound could have instilled a festering hatred of humans in the elephant, which, when combined with the chronic pain, may have compelled the elephant to its deadly rampage. This next story hits me the hardest because of the area in which it took place, New Jersey. My whole family is from New Jersey. My parents are there now as I tell this. I would spend summers as a young man with my grandparents, aunts, uncles, and cousins in towns like Toms River, Bayville, and Barnegat, New Jersey. I would actually swim in Toms River and in the ocean, in Lavalette and Ocean Gate, not knowing what had happened only years earlier. No one ever told me. Maybe now I know why. Between July 1st and July 12th, 1916, five people were attacked along the coast of New Jersey by sharks. Only one of the victims survived. The first major attack occurred on Saturday, July 1st at Beach Haven, a resort town established on Long Beach Island off the southern coast of New Jersey. Charles Epting Van Zandt, 25, of Philadelphia, was on vacation at the Ingleside Hotel with his family. Before dinner, Van Zant decided to take a quick swim in the Atlantic with a Chesapeake Bay retriever that was playing on the beach. Shortly after entering the water, Van Zant began shouting. Bathers believed he was calling to the dog, but a shark was actually biting Van Zant's legs. He was rescued by lifeguard Alexander Ott and bystander Sheridan Taylor, who claimed the shark followed him to shore as they pulled the bleeding Van Zant from the water. Van Zant's left thigh was stripped of its flesh. He bled to death on the manager's desk of the Ingleside Hotel at 6:45 p.m. Despite Van Zant's incident, beaches along the Jersey shore remained open. Sightings of large sharks swimming off the coast of New Jersey were reported by several sea captains entering the ports of Newark and New Jersey, but they were all dismissed. The second major attack occurred 45 miles north of Beach Haven at the resort town of Spring Lake, New Jersey. The victim was Charles Bruder, 27, a Swiss bell captain at the Essex and Sussex Hotel. Bruder was killed on Thursday, July 6th, 1916, while swimming 130 yards from shore. A shark bit him in the abdomen and severed his legs. Bruder's blood turned the water red. After hearing screams, a woman notified two lifeguards that a canoe with a red hull had capsized and was floating just at the water's surface. Lifeguards Chris Anderson and George White rowed to Bruder in a lifeboat and realized that he'd been bitten by a shark. They pulled him from the water, but he bled to death on the way to the shore. According to the New York Times, women were panic-stricken and fainted as Bruder's mutilated body was brought ashore. Guests and workers at the Essex and Sussex and neighboring hotels raised money for Bruder's mother in Switzerland. The next two major attacks took place in Matawan Creek near the town of Keyport on Wednesday, July 12th. Located 30 miles north of Spring Lake and inland of Raritan Bay. Matawan resembled a Midwestern town rather than an Atlantic beach resort. Matawan's location made it in an unlikely spot for a shark-human interaction. When Thomas Cottrell, sea captain and Matawan resident, spotted an 8-foot-long shark in the creek, the town dismissed him. Around 2 p.m., local boys, including epileptic Lester Stillwell, 11, were playing in a creek at that area called the Wyckoff Dock when they saw what appeared to be an old black weather-beaten board or a weathered log. A dorsal fin appeared in the water, and the boys realized this was no log, it was a shark. Before Stillwell could climb from the creek, the shark pulled him underwater. The boys ran to town for help, and several men, including local businessman Watson Stanley Fisher, 24, came to investigate. Fisher and others dived into the creek to find Stillwell, believing him to have suffered from a seizure. After locating the boy's body and attempting to return to shore, Fisher was also bitten by the shark in front of the townspeople, losing Stillwell in the process. His right thigh was severely injured, and he bled to death on Monmouth Memorial Hospital in Long Branch at 5:30 p.m. Stillwell's body was recovered 150 feet upstream from the Wyckoff Dock on July 14th. The fifth and final victim, Joseph Dunn, 14, of New York City, was attacked a half mile from Wyckoff Dock nearly 30 minutes after the fatal attacks on Stillwell and Fisher. The shark bit his left leg, but Dunn was rescued by his brother and a friend after a vicious tug-of-war battle with the shark. Joseph Dunn was taken to St. Peter's University Hospital in New Brunswick. He recovered from the bite and was released on September 15th, 1916. That was the last shark attack that summer. No one knows if it was the same shark causing all the mayhem, or was it a group of sharks? If so, what would possess multiple sharks to carry out multiple attacks along the same small area, all within 12 days? Witnesses of the Beach Haven fatality estimated that the shark was 9 feet long. A sea captain who saw the event believed it was a Spanish shark driven from the Caribbean Sea decades earlier by bombings during the Spanish-American War. Several fishermen claimed to have caught the Jersey man-eater in the days following the attacks. A blue shark was captured on July 14th near Long Branch, and 4 days later, the same Thomas Cottrell, who had seen the shark in Matawan Creek, claimed to have captured a sandbar shark with a gill net near the mouth of the creek. On July 14th, Harlem taxidermist and Barnum & Bailey lion tamer Michael Schlesser caught a 7.5-foot, 325-pound shark while fishing in Raritan Bay, only a few miles from the mouth of Matawan Creek. The shark nearly sank the boat before Schlesser killed it with a broken oar. When he opened the shark's belly, he removed a suspicious, fleshy material and bones that took up about two-thirds of a milk crate, and together it weighed 15 pounds. Scientists identified the shark as a young great white and the ingested remains as human. Schlesser mounted the shark and placed it on display in the window of a Manhattan shop on Broadway, but it was later lost. The only surviving photograph appeared in the Bronx Home News. No further attacks were reported along the Jersey Shore in the summer of 1916 after the capture of Schlesser's shark. So, did he capture the man-eater of New Jersey? We'll never know. What drives some of Mother Nature's predators to turn towards us? Is it because we are so weak, so feeble? Or is it something else more sinister, that's in control? It appears that mankind is not the only one that kills out of pleasure. Perhaps you should be more mindful when you're in the great outdoors. Don't litter. Be more respectful. And most importantly, never underestimate Mother Nature. We may be the apex predator for now, but one tiny slip, one plague, one asteroid, one solar flare could turn the tables on civilization as we know it, once again knocking us down from that top position.
Podcasting is not my full-time job. When I'm not in studio recording, I'm out running my real estate appraising business. Many times I have professional disagreements with underwriters on some of my valuations. So when I need a little help articulating what I'm trying to convey, I seek the help of AI. And what AI do I prefer to use? Well, I use Claude. When underwriters push back on a valuation, I need more than an opinion. I need defensible answers. That's why I use Claude. Claude doesn't just give me answers, it helps me think through the problem. Claude's internal and external research capabilities go way deeper than basic web searches. It thinks comprehensively, reliable analysis with proper citations for clients, turning hours of research into minutes. Connect Claude to your professional tools through MCP connectors, GitHub, Jira, HubSpot, Notion, Google Workspace, and watch it become your command center with context from all of your work. Claude is the AI for minds that don't stop, won't stop, and good enough. It's the collaborator that actually understands your entire workflow and thinks with you, not just for you. Whether you're debugging code at midnight or strategizing your next business move, Claude extends your thinking to tackle the problems that matter. Claude Code is a game changer for developers. It works directly in your terminal, understands your entire code base, and handles complex engineering tasks. Ready to tackle bigger problems? Sign up for Claude today and get 50% off Claude Pro, which includes access to Claude Code. When you use our link, claude.ai/expanded. That's Claude, claude.ai/expanded. Do it now, and you'll get 50% off your first 3 months of Claude Pro. That includes access to all of the features mentioned in today's episode. That's claude.ai/expanded. And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. Hope you like those stories. I hope everybody's having a good fall. It's my favorite time of year. I mean, absolutely, I love the weather. It's cooler. We've got ice hockey. We've got deer hunting. We've got football. We got it all. We got all the best holidays, right? We got Halloween, Thanksgiving, Christmas. I love it. Well, I guess technically Christmas is in the winter, but I love the fall. It's my favorite time of year. Speaking of Halloween, we got a special event coming up pretty soon. As some of you may know, we've partnered with Ducks Unlimited podcast, and we went up to Tennessee and did a couple shows with them. One of them's going to be really cool. I'm going to keep it quiet for now. I'm not sure if I'm supposed to disclose it or not, but I'm excited for it to come out. But anyways, we collaborated and made a DU podcast, Expanded Perspectives collaboration sticker. And there's going to be some sort of giveaway coming up soon, so you have to stay tuned. If you follow us on social media or if you follow Ducks Unlimited, you'll know as soon as I know, because I don't know the details. I know there is going to be some sort of giveaway for the stickers, but I don't know exactly all of the details. But be looking out for that. As soon as I know, I'll let everyone know. If you're on Patreon, I'll put it on Patreon as well as social media. And for you that don't listen to us on Patreon, I'm sure you'll know by the next episode. I hope everybody's out there having a good time. I hope if you have a cool story you'd like to share with me and Cam, as well as the listeners, you can email the show expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. You can also call our hotline, 888-393-2783. That's 888-393-BRUD. If you want more Expanded Perspectives and you want to help us out, don't forget about Expanded Perspectives Elite. You can go to Patreon. There's a couple different tiers over there you can sign up for. Just go to patreon.com/expandedperspectivesElite. And if you want to give a gift away, Christmas is coming up. You can give the gift of Expanded Perspectives Elite. Just go to patreon.com/expandedperspectivesElite/gift. And you're like, Kyle, what do you get on Patreon? Well, if you go to Patreon, you get to listen to ad-free versions of the regular show. So for those of you that do not like advertisements, I totally get it. When it comes to streaming services like Hulu and stuff, I pay a little upcharge just so I don't have to watch the commercials. I totally get it. But at the end of the day, this is a business and you have to make money. It costs money. But so if you want an ad-free version of the show, go to Patreon, sign up for that. Also, you can sign up for the whole entire Elite back catalog, which stretches back like, 10 years. There's lots of episodes over there that if you only listen to the free show, then you've never heard them. And it helps out the show. And we would appreciate it. Before we get out of here, we got a special email from somebody this last week that it really made my day. So I'm going to read it here. It says, "Que tal, amigos míos? I wanted to express my appreciation and gratitude for y'all and your show. Expanded Perspectives was the first podcast I ever listened to back in 2014 on my good old iPhone 5. I was even lucky enough to receive one of the logo decals that you mailed for free. So thank you, by the way. That was very generous of you. You guys even covered my strange encounter on the June 1st, 2016 episode. I apologize for my lack of writing skills and not being able to portray the details of my encounter in a more story-like, friendly way. To this day, I still don't know what chased me through the woods, but that story is 100% true. For more than a decade now, I have not missed a single episode of Expanded Perspectives. Within each episode, you give updates into your own personal lives, which is why it now feels like I'm just listening to two of my big homies shooting the breeze. Over the past couple of years, due to my declining health, I have come to rely on your show for comfort and for company. Many nights, while I'm dealing with pain, discomfort, and anxiety, I can turn on your show and it's like listening to two old friends. When all else fails, Expanded Perspectives is still able to occupy my mind and make me laugh. Thank you very much. Please keep doing what you're doing. James Cosmo Bernard. Peace, y'all. Well, James, I love the email. Thank you. That makes me feel very good. You know, it's hard to believe that two knuckleheads like Cam and I can sit here and shoot the breeze to each other in a studio on microphone, and then it's put out there. And you never know who's listening. And I'm so thankful to have all the fans we have, the listeners, the support. And yeah, man, we're going to keep doing it. As long as people are here to listen, as long as people want to share their stories, we're going to keep doing it. I hope everybody out there has a good week. James, I will be sending you some stickers, some more stickers. We got new ones since all the way back in the day when we did that free giveaway. And I'll be sure to get you the collaboration stickers we did with Expanded, with Ducks Unlimited. I hope everybody out there has a good one, safe one. Till next time, I'm Kyle. Peace.